13. The Making of the Islamic Revolution, 1977 to 1979. Between August 1978 and February 1979, a period of less than 7 months, Iran witnessed a revolution that brought down the Pahlavi regime and abolished the institution of monarchy, wiped out the privileges of the Pahlavi elite, and significantly weakened its secularized middle classes. In its stead, Ayatollah Khomeini and his associates created the Islamic Republic, which aimed to re-establish the guardianship of the jurist, Velayate Faqih, as the only legitimate model of governance. The Islamic Revolution, as it came to be known inside Iran and out, was backed by Islamic activists, many of them radicals, the urban poor, merchants of the bazaar, and for a while at least by the youth, the university students, lower-ranking government employees, and men and women of modest urban backgrounds. It was financed, at least at the outset, by sympathizers in the bazaar community and by other religiously inclined people in Tehran and other major cities, and through dues paid to local mujtahids or representatives of Khomeini. Ideologically, it was a strange mix of return to pristine Islam, the Sharia-laden worldview of Khomeini and his cohorts in Qom, notions of Islamic modernity, as understood by tie-wearing Islamists such as Mahdi Bazargan, dormant Shi'i messianic aspirations, rampant anti-Westernism, and anti-Pahlavi sentiment. It demonstrated in its earlier stages genuine aspirations for democracy, freedom of speech, and human rights, but also exhibited shades of leftist ideas as seen through the prism of the secular and the Islamic guerrilla organizations and their sympathizers, and soon the sympathizers of the revived Tudeh party. Coming in the wake of major 20th-century revolutions in Russia and China, the Islamic Revolution was informed as much by third-world post-colonial discourse as by the radicalizing experience of the Cuban Revolution, the Vietnam War, and the unfolding tragedy of the Palestinian Liberation Movement. It soon evolved into a textbook revolution with momentous domestic and international repercussions. In its historical context, the Islamic Revolution proved far more encompassing, though much less innocent, than the Constitutional Revolution 7 decades earlier. And, as it turned out, it was far less loyal to its own democratic and liberalizing promises than the Constitutional Revolution. By some stretch of historical rationale, it was also a rebellious child of the national movement of the Mossadegh era. It inherited from that era not only street politics on a much larger scale, but also a sense of defiance vis-à-vis the great powers. In its social exposure, it was more widespread than both the Constitutional Revolution and the national movement, and in certain ways it tried to complement the unfulfilled aspirations of both those events. Without falling victim to historical teleology, one can draw a line, a zigzagging and broken, but nevertheless traceable one, from the Mashru'eh demand of the constitutional period to the extremism of the Fadayan-e-Islam of the post-war era and the ideology of the Islamic Revolution. Across the wider span of the Iranian past, the Islamic Revolution may be compared in its intensity with the rise of the Safavid state and the establishment of Shi'ism as the official creed. More immediately, it was perhaps less decisive for Iran than the rise of Pahlavi state had been half a century earlier. Yet it was far more instrumental in its long-term social and demographic impact. The Islamic ideology and its beneficiaries aside, the revolution also released an unprecedented reservoir of creative energies at what may be called the social peripheries of the Iranian society. Insofar as its regional and global impact, the Islamic Revolution is the first, and so far the only, popular movement in the Muslim world that has sustained and successfully driven forward its ideological agenda. The establishment of the Islamic Republic, it can be argued, reinvigorated Islamist activism throughout the Muslim world and propelled it beyond the post-colonial nationalist and socialist aspirations, or Salafi obscurantism, of earlier decades. It is the potency of this brand of politicized Islam and its Shi'i underpinnings that transformed Iran's manifold strands of opposition into a monolithic revolution. It affected, moreover, the Islamically inspired movements of the early 1980s in neighboring Iraq, and to a lesser extent, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Lebanon, and Syria. Like any major revolution, the true beginnings of the Islamic Revolution were debated as much as its outcomes. With the benefit of hindsight, we can identify a number of systemic problems in the late Pahlavi era, especially from the mid-1970s on, which were at the root of the early protests and revolutionary impulses. The socio-economic, demographic, and cultural changes of the late Pahlavi era sharpened social divisions and contributed to public discontent. By 1976, the fall in Iran's oil revenue and subsequent budgetary shortfall had slowed down the Shah's overambitious development projects. Perennial repression, at the same time, eroded support among the middle classes and even alienated the elite. These were ingredients capable of igniting some form of social protest, but are perhaps not enough to explain the potency of the forthcoming revolution and its swift success. In the mid-1970s, and as late as 1977, only the most radical trends on the Iranian left, such as the Fadayan-e-Khalq and Mujahideen-e-Khalq guerrilla organizations, yearned for a revolution on the Marxist model, a prospect unforeseen at the time, even by the most astute observers. The near vanquishing of urban guerrilla organizations by the mid-1970s relegated that project to the distant future, though no doubt sharpened public resentment among a younger generation of Iranians. The road to revolution was to be paved, however, not by guerrilla warfare, but by mass support for a prophetic figure, the likes of whom Iran had rarely seen in its recent past. Ayatollah Khomeini and his cohorts, who reaped the fruits of many decades of fury, benefited from a unique opportunity to build their own monopoly on power. First sparks. Signs of political protests came rather unexpectedly with a change in the international climate. During the US presidential campaign in the fall of 1976, Jimmy Carter, the Democratic candidate, made human rights and free speech the major concern of his foreign policy. The worldwide echo quickly reached Iran and raised new hopes. Though primarily aimed at the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc, Carter's advocacy, even before assuming office in January 1977, sent a positive signal to Iranian liberal opposition, including veterans of the former National Front, lawyers, intellectuals, journalists, and dormant revolutionaries from the olden days. Encouraged by Carter's initiative, a reversal of Nixon's support for pro-US dictators worldwide, in early 1977, individuals and small groups began writing open letters addressed to Premier Hoveydar and to the Shah, criticizing human rights violations and demanding greater accountability. They also raised concerns about the state's flawed economic policies, wasteful and mismanaged development projects, nepotism and corruption in high office, dysfunctional bureaucracy, culture of subservience and sycophancy, alienating social policies, and ill effects of the Shah's autocratic style. These voices, audible after years of silence, were a refreshing breeze in a climate of royal adulation and chronic subservience. Hoveydar's premiership, after 13 dreary years of holding office, seemed vulnerable. In his familiar fashion, the Shah, who was the root cause of many of the state's failed policies, began to point the finger of blame at his subordinates, and Hoveydar was the first to go. Open letters, having been widely circulated in intellectual and clerical circles by means of photocopies and word of mouth, however, held responsible not only Hoveydar, but implicitly the Shah. These were the first critical statements not retaliated by the Savak, at least not immediately. The mellow response was bound to be interpreted by the still amorphous opposition as a sign of the Shah's readjustment to the new US administration. On June 12, 1977, when an open letter addressed to the Shah by Karim Sanjabi, Dariush Farahar, and Shapur Bakhtiar was first circulated, neither the authors nor the recipient or readers could have perceived the enormity of the upheavals that 18 months later would bring the Pahlavi regime to its knees. The authors warned the Shah, "At this juncture, when we submit this letter, the country is at the brink of an abyss. All efforts have reached a dead end. Public necessities, and particularly the price of foodstuffs and housing, have swollen tremendously and caused shortages. Agriculture and livestock have reached near extinction. Budding national industries and human resources are in crisis and on shaky grounds, and the trade imbalance reflecting an import-export discrepancy is startling. The oil revenue, this God-given blessing, has been seriously mismanaged, and programs that were presented under the rubric of reform and the White Revolution have remained unfulfilled. Worst of all, the disregard for human rights and personal and social liberties, a breach of the very foundation of the Constitution, together with signs of extreme terror, growing corruption, decadence, and sycophancy, have brought national morale to its lowest ebb. The unusually blunt tone, reflecting the angry mood of the time, was complemented by a plea that the Shah take a conciliatory course before it became too late. The only road to salvation and relief from the current difficulties and pitfalls that threaten the future of Iran is to abandon autocratic rule, fully comply with the values of the constitutional regime, Mashrutiyat, restore the rights of the people, truly respect the Constitution and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, set aside the one-party system, allow freedom of the press and freedom of association, free political prisoners and political exiles, and establish a regime based on elected representatives of the people, who, according to the Constitution, are accountable for the conduct of the government. It is wrong to believe that President Carter's advocacy of human rights was solely responsible for raising such voices or for the Shah's greater latitude. By 1977, the effects of mismanagement, corruption in state projects, and unpopular price stabilization measures were palpable enough to prompt protest. The global recession and the ensuing revenue shortfall caused by the glut in the oil market further slowed government projects. The perennial criticism from international human rights organizations, Amnesty International in particular, over military tribunals, mock trials, and treatment of political prisoners darkened the regime's image. President Carter's human rights policy thus was more of a stimulant than a prime cause, a conduit through which the subterranean reservoir of social discontent found its way to the surface and soon erupted in a revolutionary movement. The Shah's health also had some bearing on the rapidly shifting climate. In the early 1970s, he had been diagnosed with a mild case of lymphoma, a condition that for years was guarded with the utmost secrecy. For the first few years, evidently in a state of denial, he conceived of no realistic plans for the transfer of power. He did appoint Queen Farah as viceroy to the minor crown prince Reza, but this was for the most part a formality. In a male-dominated Pahlavi court, where all matters great and small hinged on royal approval, even minute details of military and civilian affairs, the Shah could not afford to be seen as a cancer patient or a dying man. The entire system relied on the royal persona exuding an image of resolve and confidence. Yet that was exactly what seemed to have been missing. By 1977, when his cancer was no longer in remission, it seemingly impaired the Shah's ability to make crucial decisions. His appetite for European prostitutes remained intact, as his court minister and confidant Asadullah Alam noted in his secret diaries. Though the Shah still promised his people an impending arrival at the gates of the great civilization, though in a tone more subdued than before, there was a noticeable anxiety in his conduct. He forecast dark days ahead if people were to be lured by what he labelled the coalition of the red and black reactionaries, a not-so-subtle code for the radical left and clerical dissenters. Soon after, officials held responsible for the mismanagement of the state projects were dismissed. The appointment of Jamshid Amuzgar, 1923-2016, on August 7, 1977, as the new prime minister, was seen as the regime's clear response to the restive popular mood. In retrospect, it was also the Shah's first in a series of grave, possibly irrevocable errors of judgment. Amuzgar was an American-educated economist with a doctorate from Cornell University. He was untainted by rampant venalities and dutiful in his professional conduct. For a long time, he had served as the finance minister and as Iran's chief negotiator at OPEC. The skeptical general public, nevertheless, could not see him as anything but the Shah's loyal servant and facilitator, an image reaffirmed by the fact that he was the leader of the Rastakhiz Party's so-called progressive wing. His choices of cabinet ministers, with a few exceptions, were also mere window dressing. They were predictable faces that had caressed the royal ego and followed his wishes uncritically, even slavishly. Amuzgar's public statements only imbued a message of conformity. At a time when criticism of the regime was on the rise, he was content to highlight cumbersome bureaucracy and lack of coordination as primarily responsible for public frustration. The contrived image of a progressive wing of the Rastakhiz Party proved even more of a liability, as Amuzgar, concurrent with his premiership, was appointed to the post of Secretary-General of that crumbling party. On balance, Amuzgar's year-long government that was meant to be a calming breeze only fueled the revolutionary fires. He managed to secure a limited degree of nominal freedom for the press and political activities. He even managed to restrict some of Savak's most egregious practices of illegal arrests and torture. Yet the release of political prisoners, which began in his time, an end to the secret military tribunals that had sent so many dissidents to prison, and lowering of the deafening tone of state propaganda, all relayed to the animated general public a message of the state's weakness and even desperation. Conciliatory gestures triggered further protests in the universities, and soon thereafter in venues dominated by radical activists. By September 1978, the public shift from acts of protest to a revolutionary mode was palpable. If there had indeed been a flicker of hope for the Amuzgar government to rescue the troubled regime from the verge of a revolutionary inferno, this was dashed by frequent mass demonstrations, acts of sabotage by the Islamic extremists, and crippling strikes by workers in the public sector and the oil industry. On June the 19th, 1977, the death of Ali Shariati was believed by many among his supporters to be because of foul play. 3 months later, news of the death of Mustafa Khomeini, 1930 to 1977, the Ayatollah's older son, was also received by the public, similar to Shariati's death, almost as a martyrdom. Though he had died of illness, somehow his death was seen as instigated by the sinister regime. In a closed society where the leader of the country, most members of its political elite, and some leading intellectuals were openly subscribing to conspiratorial theories, it was quite plausible that many non-elite would entertain similar ideas. Demonstrations in Tehran University among the growing ranks of Shariati's followers, which coincided with a deluge of condolences from all quarters forwarded to Khomeini, shared a common sentiment of holding the regime responsible for the death of both figures. After 14 years of exile in Najaf, Khomeini once more was about to re-emerge as the most relentless critic of the Pahlavi state. He enjoyed support not only from among his clerical and lay followers, but also within the general public, who hailed him as a champion of resistance. Yet by no means was he yet viewed as the sole leader of the protest movement, or even as the man at its forefront. Exiled, but not forgotten, he patiently had waited out years in the social wilderness, perhaps with little hope of ever going back to Iran, let alone leading a revolution. For younger generations of Iranians, Ayatollah Khomeini was a figure of the opposition from the past who had returned to the political stage. An opportune moment seemed to have miraculously propelled him to the forefront of a powerful movement, and despite his best of expectations, his image would soon be surrounded by an aura of sanctity. On September the 14th, 1977, the congregational prayer for the Feast of Fitr, at the end of the fasting month of Ramadan, was attended by tens of thousands of worshippers in the neighbourhood of Gaytariyeh, at an open space in the north of the capital that was chosen by Khomeini's supporters for the occasion. An orderly congregation, for the first time, exhibited the new organizing capabilities of the Islamic activists. Shortly thereafter, a largely obscure group of activists, known as Iran's militant clerics, Ruhaniyune Mabareze Iran, all former students of Khomeini, went on to announce that the Iranian Muslim nation would not cease its struggle until the crumbling foundations of the current regime were supplanted by an Islamic Unitarian society. This was an unveiled challenge to the Shah and his government, displaying clear solidarity with the exiled Ayatollah. The 10 evenings of poetry reading by well-known Iranian literary figures, mostly dissident intellectuals and some Tudeh sympathizers, held in October 1977 in Tehran's Goethe Institute, was a match to the show of Islamic sentiments. Among them were the poets Mahdi Akhavan Sales and Hashang Ebtehaj, the novelist Simin Daneshvar, and the playwright Gholam Hossein Saedi. The experience of listening to the icons of modern Persian poetry and prose, reciting poems and passages brimming with symbolic references to repression, resistance, and rebellion, was highly inspiring to the animated audience, which were estimated to be a few thousand on the opening night. The subtext of the event, and the thrilling mood among the packed crowds that attended the Nights of Poetry, was predictably anti-Pahlavi, but hardly pro-Islamic. The sheer excitement of uttering long-withheld feelings of discontent, mostly through the powerful medium of poetry, was empowering, especially in an atmosphere of fear of the regime's retaliation. Though apprehensive of the radical clergy and their growing ambition, the intellectuals and their audiences showed their implicit solidarity with other voices of opposition, which included the supporters of Ayatollah Khomeini. Shedding tears for the island of stability. By the fall of 1977, the protest movement had moved beyond Iranian cities to become more tangible to the world beyond. Rallies held by dissident Iranian students during the Shah's visit to the United States exposed the depth of anti-Pahlavi sentiments. Since the early 1960s, thousands of Iranian students abroad, then one of the largest contingents of foreign students in Europe and the United States, had posed vocal opposition to the Shah and protested his autocratic rule, mostly under the umbrella of the Confederation of Iranian Students. An influential contingent within this confederation consisted of sympathizers of the Tudeh party. Maoists and independent Marxists were also active. Others were affiliated with the National Front or had no political affiliation. A much smaller contingent consisted of Islamic student associations. Idealistic and ideologically divided, except in their opposition to the Shah, the Confederation gained greater visibility in the early 1970s. Through pamphlets, public campaigns on university campuses, demonstrations, sit-ins, shows of solidarity with other student organizations, and the occasional takeover of Iranian consulates in Europe, the Confederation had become a force to be reckoned with. A source for embracing the Iranian regime and a thorn in the side of the Pahlavi narrative of serenity and splendor, the Confederation remained vocal despite a few defections to the regime's side. A test of the Shah's unpopularity with the opposition abroad became more visible in a violent demonstration in front of the U.S. White House in November 1977, when the Iranian monarch was on a state visit. Divided up into numerous splinter groups, the Confederation nevertheless managed to marshal about 1,000 members and affiliates for a rally. In turn, the Iranian embassy in Washington, under Ambassador Ardeshir Zahedi, arranged for nearly 5,000 pro-regime students from all over North America. They were to be reimbursed for their travel expenses and with pocket money thrown in. The showdown between the two sides could not have come at a less opportune moment for President Carter and his royal guest. The anti-Shah demonstrators, in sympathy with the striking students in the Iranian universities, clashed with the police as they crossed the police lines and attacked their opponents near the White House. A few hundred yards away, on the South Lawn, the Shah and President Carter, accompanied by Queen Farah and Rosalind Carter, were standing on a raised platform erected for the occasion. They were putting on public view a solid alliance between the two countries. Yet their speeches, through the public address system, were barely audible against the loud anti-Pahlavi slogans in the background. The demonstrators called the Shah a murderous dictator, a U.S. puppet, and a corrupt squanderer of the nation's wealth. Still worse, the ceremony had to be cut short when smoke from the tear gas canisters deployed by Washington police to disperse the crowd inadvertently reached the royal guests and their hosts. Tears were running down their cheeks in front of television cameras as the indignant Shah reached into his pocket and brought out his handkerchief. The accidental tears were not merely shed in a moment of disgrace. They were an ominous preview of what was to come in the months ahead. The Shah's customary pilgrimage to Washington upon the arrival of any new administration, Carter's being the seventh since 1949, was intended to receive U.S. blessings as a vital strategic ally, even though misgivings about his domestic policies remained at an all-time high. Misgivings aside, in the eyes of the Carter administration, the Shah was too important an ally to be quickly abandoned or chastised merely on his human rights records and his repression at home, even if disturbing reports of unrest in Iran and the student rally in Washington bluntly showcased his unpopularity. After initially giving him the cold shoulder, the administration began to somewhat warm up to the Shah and tried to gratify his insatiable appetite for military hardware. To repair the Shah's bruised image as a U.S.-backed potentate, his friends and supporters in Washington had already launched a rehabilitation campaign. Former Vice President Nelson Rockefeller, and soon after Henry Kissinger, both longtime advocates of the Pahlavi crown, visited Tehran to assuage the royal mind and assuring the Shah of solid support among the Republican ranks. As a gesture of goodwill toward Iran, after months of resistance, on the eve of the 1977 royal visit, the U.S. Congress ratified the sale of $1.2 billion in airborne early warning and control system, AWACS, aircraft, then the cutting edge of reconnaissance technology. The sale was meant to equip Iran and, in effect, to enable the U.S. government that received security intelligence through Iran with a powerful tool along its common borders with the Soviet Union. Mending fences with the Shah also was desirable at that time, on the eve of the peace negotiations between Egypt and Israel, a process in which the Shah had acted as an important early mediator between the Prime Minister of Israel, Golda Meir, and the Egyptian President. 3 days after the Shah's Washington visit, President Anwar al-Sadat of Egypt arrived in Jerusalem for the first round of face-to-face talks with Israeli leaders. On the other side of the troubled region, the fall of the Pakistani President Zulfikar Ali Bhutto in July 1977, after a military coup that brought to power General Muhammad Zia-ul-Haq, alarmed both Washington and Tehran. For years, the Shah had backed Bhutto with military and financial support in the hopes that he could stay in power and remain a friendly secular ally and neighbor. General Zia, on the other hand, reacted tamely to U.S. interests but appeased the Pakistani Islamist parties. His takeover was the first symptom of a worrying shift toward Islamism that soon was to become a hallmark of Pakistani politics, and inevitably the Shah had to act as a U.S. surrogate in stabilizing Pakistan. Finally, declining oil demand in the world markets was a serious concern for both sides. The Shah advocated greater price stabilization so as to secure funds for his ambitious military and civilian projects and to bring vitality to Iran's stagnant economy. Soon after his return to Iran, the Shah, having been reassured of U.S. moral and material support, staged a show of power. Even though Savak's wings were somewhat clipped by the Amuzgar government, and eventually in June 1978 a new chief was appointed in place of General Nasiri to reform the organization, it was still unrestrained enough to retaliate against sporadic trouble spots throughout the country. Savak agents carried out an attack on a meeting called by the newly revived National Front in a private garden near Karaj, in the vicinity of Tehran, and hundreds were indiscriminately beaten up and arrested. They were mostly secular intellectuals and university students. A follow-up crackdown on university students aimed to quash months of protests and clashes with the police. The clampdown proved an obvious misjudgment, the first in a series of tactical errors by the security forces, for it only solidified the forces of opposition. Yet, during his short stay in Tehran on New Year's Eve of 1978, President Carter, at a banquet given in his honor, toasted the Shah and declared Iran an island of stability in the troubled Middle East. A misstatement that was destined to gain some notoriety, it appeared in the official reports along with pictures of President Carter holding a glass of champagne and flanked by Princess Ashraf, who at the time was perhaps the most unpopular member of the Pahlavi family. Only 2 days prior to President Carter's arrival, accompanied on the trip by Secretary of State Cyrus Vance and National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzeziński, the American-Iranian Cultural Center building in Tehran, a hub of American-inspired cultural activities and language learning, was bombed by the Fadayan-e-Khalq guerrillas. The opposition condemned the miscalculated American gesture as an affront to the Iranian people. But the U.S. apparent insensitivity was only topped 8 months later by a visit by the Premier of the People's Republic of China. Hua Guofeng's state visit to Iran in September 1978 came at a time when the revolutionary firestorm, in which Iranian Maoists were an integral part, were about to consume the very survival of the Pahlavi regime. It was as if neither the US nor the Chinese could yet grasp the force of the revolution in offing. Toward a revolutionary course. By late 1977, the regime's response to street protests was to use the liberalized press to its own advantage. Already in August, an article attacking Mossadegh appeared on the anniversary of the 1953 coup, presumably to counterbalance the rising pro-National Front sentiments. A week after Carter's departure, and buoyed by the presumed US blessing of the Shah, the Rastakhiz Party held a convention in Tehran that hosted 10,000 strong from all over the country. In its resolution, the convention declared all-embracing combat against colonialism, euphemism in the Pahlavi parlance for the politicized Shi'i clergy and their alleged ties to the British in colonial times. A predictable and baseless ploy, it was rooted in the British authorities' distribution of the proceeds of the Ard Endowment, Pul Le Hind, and similar Indian endowments among the Shi'i Mojtahids in Ottoman Iraq and later during the British Mandate. The next propaganda volley that followed proved an utter disaster. On January 8, 1978, an article appeared in the daily Etelaat, often the mouthpiece of the Pahlavi establishment, attacking Ayatollah Khomeini in spiteful terms. Apparently planted by the Ministry of the Court against the wishes of the paper's editor and using a pseudonym, the article condemned the Alliance of the Red and the Black Reactionaries and denounced Khomeini and the Shi'i clerical leadership as turbaned servants of colonialism who had clung to a reactionary worldview and a corrupt culture. Khomeini was accused of being an opium addict, who was assigned by his masters to incite sedition and derail Iran's march to progress and prominence. He was an adventurer, a faithless and ambitious man associated with and subservient to colonial powers, stated the invective article. A man with a mysterious past who was attached to the most reactionary colonial elements. Since he failed to acquire a status among the country's most senior clergy, despite all the suspicious support that he had received, he sought for an opportunity to make a name for himself by means of inciting a political adventure. Outraged by the Etelaat article, a day later, on January 9, 1978, supporters of Khomeini, mostly seminarians, tallied in the city of Qom and clashed with security forces. As many as 6 of the protesters were killed and more were injured. The Qom riot, in retrospect, triggered a turning point in the calendar of the Islamic Revolution, for it launched a whole year of rallies, strikes, and violence, resulting in a steady waning of state's power in all major cities. By January 1978, the revolutionary course, with its thrill and terror, had hit full stride, with the militant clergy about to appear at the helm. The revolutionary course, moreover, compelled more senior clerical figures, almost grudgingly, to declare their support for Ayatollah Khomeini. One after another, the Qom Marjas were obligated to issue statements giving their mandate and condemning the crackdown by the security forces. Up until then, most Marjas had viewed Khomeini as a troublemaker and feared his threat to their authority. Even moderate Ayatollahs, such as Mahamad Kazem Shariatmadari, 1905-1986, could no longer remain equivocal. Senior students of Khomeini, among them Hossein Ali Montazeri, 1922-2009, were instrumental in elevating Khomeini to a status above others and above the Marjaiyat status. Though not yet fully spelled out, the notion of Velayate Faqih was beginning to place Khomeini far above his cohorts, not merely as a jurist, but also as a saviour of the nation. By January the 18th, Tabriz, then the second largest Iranian city, was the scene of a violent two-day uprising with many casualties. The angry crowd burned down banks, government buildings, provincial headquarters of the Rastakhiz party, cinemas, and a Pepsi-Cola bottling facility. Once the unrest continued into the second day, the government declared martial law in Tabriz and brought troops into the streets. This was the first time since the uprising of June 1963 that martial law had been declared, hence adding to the public anxiety and fear that worse things were to come. Further unrest in Ahwaz, Mashhad, Yazd, and Isfahan turned the crisis national and gave it the appearance of ominous regularity. Throughout 1978, demonstrations recurred on the 40th morning commemoration, Arba'in, of the martyrs who had fallen in the earlier round of clashes. This began with a remembrance for Gome and Tabriz victims and soon gained a fixed rhythm, with unmistakable hinting at the Shi'i tragedies of Karbala. The numbers of victims almost invariably were exaggerated in the same way that government's punitive actions were overstated. Rallies throughout the country, leading to fresh clashes with the police and soon with the armed forces, coincided with debilitating strikes in the public sector, among teachers, students and university professors, government employees, factory workers, public utility workers, and even the civilian cadres of the armed forces. Sit-ins at universities and government offices and collective hunger strikes, called political fasting, were the order of the day. The demands listed by demonstrators ranged from tangible grievances and realistic objectives, such as salary raises, job benefits, and the meeting of housing needs, to political demands rooted in decades of discontent. These ranged from the unconditional release of all political prisoners, an end to press censorship, and prosecution of corrupt officials, to the more idealistic calls inspired by the left, an end to plundering Iran's natural resources, liberating the Iranian currency from the financial hegemony of the US dollar, and ending all the so-called montage industries. The latter was a reference to assembly plants manufacturing mostly Western consumer goods under license, enterprises dismissed by armchair revolutionaries who probably had read too much Ali Ahmad as somehow inauthentic and useless. In the mosques, the radicalized clergy preached from the pulpits, and in the hastily set up Islamic associations, in factories, government offices, universities, schools, and private firms overnight, activists demanded the swift exercise of Islamic justice and the removal from power of agents of the idol, Taghut, a Quranic term euphemized to stand for the Shah and the Pahlavi elite. In university rallies, where the left held the upper hand, cries of victory to peoples, Khalkha, of Iran, and an end to the exploitation of the masses were audible. Still more widespread, the supporters of the People's Mujahideen, the fastest-growing political movement among youth, called for victory of the disinherited of the earth, Mustazafine Ars, and the establishment of a classless Islamic society. A language of political Islam, inherited from the likes of Ali Shariati, quickly shaped the revolutionary discourse. With great speed, the list of demands, and the radical slogans that went with them, travelled from one protest camp to another, adding to the excitement of the multitudes whose forbidden sentiments were finally spilling out after years of silence. During the month of Ramadan, the protest movement gained new momentum. On August the 11th, 1978, following clashes with police in Isfahan, the angry crowd set fire to cinemas, liquor stores, banks, government buildings, and Rastakhiz headquarters. Even trees along sidewalks of the historic Chahar Bagh were uprooted to block the advancing security force. In response, the Emuzgar government declared martial law in the city. As if that was not enough, 9 days later, on August the 19th, coinciding with the anniversary of the 1953 coup, a horrendous tragedy in Abadan reversed the course of the protests in favour of the Islamic militants. An act of arson in the Rex cinema resulted in the death of 377 men, women and children. They were burned to death or died of asphyxiation behind the locked doors of the movie hall. Ironically, the movie on the screen, Gavazan Ha, The Deer, 1976, by the Iranian director Masoud Kimiyai, almost anticipated the coming of a revolution. It was about solidarity of the underclasses, portrayed in a thief and a drug addict, whose desperate rebellion against social injustices brought them to a violent showdown with security forces. The movie received a screening permit from SAVAK with great difficulty, and only after substantial re-editing. From what is known, the Rex Cinema's exit doors were intentionally locked. Widespread rumours at the time held SAVAK and the pro-government agent provocateur responsible. Yet the arson was consistent with a pattern of Islamic activists setting ablaze cinemas and other venues of supposed Western decadence for more than a decade, as was witnessed in many instances of arson that destroyed cinemas, first in Gome and later in other cities. The Rex Cinema incident displayed the perpetrators' utter lack of moral scruples, as became evident in the course of their trial a few months later. The Islamic opposition, however, stood to reap major propaganda advantages from the tragedy in the prevailing environment of suspicion and anger. The Amuzgar government faced intense criticism for mishandling both the Isfahan riots and the Rex Cinema incident. Criticism came not only from the general public, but also from the Majlis as well, whose deputies, having serious credibility issues, tried to behave as the people's genuine representatives. Amuzgar's resignation on August the 27th was a serious blow to the regime's hope for stabilizing the restive climate. His resignation proved that a smooth reform movement by a chosen member of the Pahlavi technocracy could not remedy many years of absolutist rule. It was too little and too late. Plunged into a deeper crisis of confidence, the Shah appointed as new Prime Minister Jafar Sharif Emami, who twice had served in the same office in the late 1950s. This proved another misstep, one even graver than Amuzgar's appointment a year earlier. Sharif Emami, the President of the Senate, and concurrently head of the Pahlavi Foundation, and a member of the board of various private enterprises, was a quintessential insider. He was too closely associated with the Shah and the upper echelons of the Pahlavi elite to have any chance of withstanding the revolutionary storm that was sweeping the country. A wheeler and dealer and a facilitator of high-stakes foreign and domestic deals, his public image left much to be desired. His only perceived credentials in the eyes of the Shah and his advisers were that he was from a well-known clerical family and a devout Muslim who held ties in clerical circles. His National Reconciliation Government, as he liked to call it, comprised predictable Pahlavi officials who aimed to mend fences with the moderate clergy through persuasion and appeasement. By doing so, he hoped to isolate Khomeini and his supporters and open up, at least partially, the political space. That the Shah at the time did not opt for a more credible figure from among veteran statesmen suggested that even by August 1978, he had difficulty grasping the depth of the revolutionary realities. He still entertained conspiratorial fantasies about Khomeini and the clerical radicals around him, whom he continued to label as black reactionaries, as if they were somehow creatures of a British plot, or even the American CIA. Opting for a moderate figure from among the liberal opposition may have been the only hope to realistically preserve the constitutional monarchy, if not the Shah himself on the throne. That option, of course, required a near-complete delegation of authority by the Shah to a reasonably credible government, holding of a free and fair election, and even the Shah's peaceful abdication in favour of his son and successor. At the time, these were concessions the Shah had great difficulty granting. Nor were they palatable to the senior generals of his army or the security apparatus that he had fostered for long. His record of 37 years on the throne showed little evidence that he would ever be willing to make such concessions. Stressing his independence and calling for an end to royal meddling in the affairs of the government, Sharif Emami nevertheless embarked on a series of remedies and a morality campaign to assuage public opinion. He abolished the imperial calendar, Shahanshahi, initiated by the Shah 2 years earlier, and reverted back to the customary Iranian solar calendar that started with the Hijra. He closed down nightclubs and casinos and introduced anti-corruption and austerity measures. He raised the salaries of the discontented government employees, released a number of activist clerics from prison, and returned others from internal exile, and forced into retirement a handful of senior army officers with reputations for fraud. He relaxed censorship of the press and the media, accepted the existence of multiple political parties, and by doing so put an effective end to the Rastakhiz party. Even the Tudeh party re-emerged after a quarter of a century of surviving in exile. In response, Ayatollah Shariat Madari cautiously welcomed the measures introduced by Sharif Emami's government and offered a 3-month window to implement other public demands. The newly revived National Front issued a 12-point declaration calling for restoration of the constitution, free press and free elections, and dissolution of the SAVAK. Yet the appeasement policy generated the reverse effect. It emboldened the opposition, and under popular pressure compelled the Marjaz of Qom to further support Khomeini and his increasingly militant statements from Najaf and soon after from Paris. Khomeini labelled the government measures as nothing short of hypocrisy. A massive rally of hundreds of thousands across the length of the capital from north to south was followed by a congregational prayer held in the middle of a public square. It displayed, with an impressive show of discipline, public solidarity with Khomeini and his cohort. The organizing capabilities of the Islamic opposition were on display only 3 days later, on September 4, 1978, when more than 200,000 marchers in Tehran carried thousands of placards with Khomeini's portrait and banners openly hostile to the regime. They rallied to Shahyad Square, soon to be renamed Freedom Square, crying out death to the Shah and calling for sovereignty, freedom, and Islamic government. Fraternizing with the troops who were brought to the streets in anticipation of violent clashes, protesters placed roses and carnations in the rifle barrels of the troops, apparently inspired by the 1974 Carnation Revolution in Portugal. The gesture soon became commonplace. Rhymed slogans filled the air. My brother in uniform? Why fratricide? Baradare arteshi, chera baradakashi. Made up mostly of conscripts carrying out their military service, many of the troops were sympathetic to the protesters' emotional pleas. Black Friday and its aftermath. Deeply troubled by widespread protests and paralyzing strikes, and fearing worse, the Sharif Emami government extended martial law to Tehran and 11 other major cities in the country. Backed by elements within the army, and no doubt with the Shah's blessing, and the knowledge of the American and British envoys who regularly were consulted by the Shah, General Ghulam Ali Ovaisi, 1918-1984, the commander-in-chief of the army and a staunch Pahlavi loyalist, was appointed military commander of the capital. These draconian measures were meant to nip the revolutionary movement in the bud. As it turned out, the last-ditch effort instead sealed the fate of the Shah and the Pahlavi rule. On September the 8th, a day after the declaration of martial law, a large crowd gathered in Jolleh Square, the core of a religious middle-class neighbourhood in east-central Tehran that had been the scene of repeated demonstrations since the beginning of the unrest. Defiant, and possibly unaware that martial law had just been declared, demonstrators ignored repeated warnings to disperse. Sniper shots from the leftist elements in the crowd, who evidently were members of former guerrilla organizations, further unnerved the troops. In a tense moment, the troops opened fire on the panicked crowd. The 2-hour street battle that followed left behind as many as 95 dead and many wounded, including women and children. Other clashes around the capital resulted in even more casualties. The emotional impact of these events, which soon was marked on the calendar of the Islamic Revolution as Black Friday, was greater even than the loss of human lives. It further alienated the regime and set the revolution almost on a course of no return. If there had been a hope among members of the secular opposition to end the Shah's autocratic rule but preserve the constitutional monarchy, that was diminished. The clerical activists, backed by the Qom Marjaz, capitalized on the Jolleh Square massacre to paint the regime as brutal and illegitimate. Aided by a rumour-mongering machine that became fully operational in the absence of reliable media and news reporting, the number of casualties, the martyrs, on the path of Islam, was inflated to thousands, and the troops who opened fire on them were labelled as Israeli mercenaries who were brought in to crush the revolution. There was a decided loss of confidence among the military personnel, both officers and troops. They were reluctantly dragged into the midst of a revolutionary struggle and asked to defend an unpopular regime and shoot at ordinary Iranians like themselves. Events of the next 7 months clearly illustrated the security forces' moral conundrum and their diminishing appetite to save the Pahlavi regime, especially in the absence of a resolute royal master. Facing violent defiance in the streets and the army's failure to effectively enforce martial law, the Sharif Emami government looked elsewhere for help. Reacting to a flurry of smuggled cassette tapes with fiery messages from Khomeini calling on the Iranian people to rise up and oust the Shah, the Iranian government could only plead with Saddam Hussein to remove Khomeini from Najaf. Once he was banished from his base, it was naively hoped, the troublesome cleric would lose contact with his constituency in Iran and eventually wither into oblivion. For Saddam Hussein, too, who by 1978 as vice president had solidified his control over the Ba'ath Party of Iraq, Khomeini appeared more of a liability inside Iraq than an asset against Iran. Even considering the grudge Saddam nursed against the Shah and the Iranians, this was a request that he could not have easily turned down, given the Ba'athist antagonism toward the rest of Iraqi Shi'is. Khomeini, Saddam feared, was a dangerous role model for the Iraqi clerical activists, such as Mohammad Bagher Sadr, 1935-1980, with whom Khomeini maintained close ties. On Saddam's orders, Khomeini was forced out of Najaf and unceremoniously dumped at the Kuwaiti border. Once refused entry into Kuwait, he considered Lebanon, Libya, and Algeria, but decided against them out of fear of civil war in the former and manipulation by dictators in the latter. He was then persuaded by some of his aides to go to France. The role of Sadegh Ghozadeh, 1936-1982, a longtime activist and avid supporter of Khomeini, was instrumental in the choice of the land of Farangiz. France was a safe haven even for a steadfast Shi'i jurist, not only because the Sharia allowed for taking refuge at perilous times in the land of unbelievers, but also because it allowed him to resume his struggle free of harassment. On October 6, 1978, he flew to Paris and shortly afterward took up residence in a small villa in Neuf-le-Château, a middle-class suburb of Paris. Sufficiently austere and frugal, the rented red bungalow was close enough to the French capital to allow for accessibility to a string of visitors who soon crowded the modest resident. He found himself surrounded by a host of aides and supporters, mostly laymen, as well as members of the Iranian opposition, his former students, and enthusiastic scholars and intellectuals who came to pay homage. Television personalities, press correspondents, and freelance writers from all over Europe and the United States also began to arrive. To the delight of the Ayatollah and his aides, and to the disgust of the Iranian authorities, his stay in Paris offered Khomeini an unprecedented 3 months of free exposure to world media and sympathetic visitors, who almost invariably treated him with awed deference. Sitting cross-legged and leaning against an apple tree in the small courtyard of his residence, which became an open-door public space for his frequent audiences and daily prayers, clad in traditional Shi'i clerical attire, a black turban and a black robe over a long white shirt, the white-bearded but robust Ayatollah appeared to most of his Iranian visitors to be a fatherly figure and a national saviour. To most Westerners, he appeared a curious, if not exotic, dissident from another time and place. His austere demeanour and his piercing gaze confirmed an uncompromising message of solidarity and defiance. Facing the media, Khomeini skillfully handled the press by answering prepared questions cautiously and concisely. Television interviewers, correspondents from the New York Times, Le Monde, and The Guardian, as well as freelancers, were often bewildered as they tried to read into Khomeini's ascetic facade and deceptively brief answers. They often went away with implicit praise for a man who had resolutely defied the Shah's autocratic rule. To the anxious members of the Iranian secular opposition, as well as Western journalists, he portrayed the revolt against the Pahlavi regime as an all-embracing liberation movement under the banner of Islam, while remaining deliberately equivocal on his perceived Islamic utopia. While painting a rosy picture of justice and equity under the Islamic Republic, he at the same time stressed that the mandate of the people of Iran would determine the shape of the future order. He further stressed that the envisioned Islamic Republic would treat all its citizens as equals, including Jews, Christians, Nasranian, or the Nazarenes, and other lawful minorities. The clergy, who had the loftier task of offering moral guidance to the nation, would refrain from political ambitions and monopolizing power. The future for Islamic Iran would include the coexistence of all groups and tendencies, while preserving Islam at the core of its sovereignty and religious identity. Whether these were sincere pronouncements, wishfully embellished by his advisers, or deceptive tactics to lessen anxieties in Iran and internationally at the prospect of an Islamic theocratic state, was a matter left to individuals' judgments. What was clear, however, was that contrary to the Iranian government's hopes, Khomeini's defiant tone and message of rebellion found a far greater audience in Iran and recognition abroad. The remaining months of Sharif Emami's government were riddled with more violent clashes and angry demonstrations. Debilitating strikes spread through the public sector, from the oil fields and refineries to banks and radio and television broadcasting and to the gas and electric supplies. Pressure on state coffers became more tangible once the government raised salaries and pensions in the vain hope of placating the voice of the opposition. It also tried, but with little success, to appease the more conservative marjas in Qom and Najaf as a counter to Khomeini. Under pressure, the government also sacked a number of senior government employees with shady reputations, detained former ministers and high officials, and brought corruption charges against them. It blacklisted yet others and banned their travel abroad, and it imposed stringent regulations, though difficult to enforce, on the flight of capital abroad. Electricity and fuel shortages, a predictable outcome of the strike in the energy sector, only added to popular discontent. The anti-corruption measures and the government's tone of appeasement only emboldened the opposition, which was succeeding in mobilizing new followers through the mosques and Mahram associations. Elements from among the Fadayan-e-Khalq and Mujahideen-e-Khalq also were lending their support to what they perceived to be an impending armed struggle. Paying lip service to Khomeini, the left was hard at work recruiting, especially among high school and university students. Many from Tudeh backgrounds and other leftist tendencies aligned themselves with their families' past affiliations. They viewed the rise to prominence of Khomeini and the Islamist fervour as a transient phase that would pave the way for the rule of the masses. Others in the liberal nationalist camp perceived some form of future power sharing with the Islamists, hoping that Khomeini's leadership would champion a free and fair constitutional regime, admittedly with a thin Islamic veneer. As it turned out, both the left and the liberals grossly underestimated Khomeini's shrewd manoeuvring and the extent of popular support he had mustered. On November 5, 1978, widespread riots in the streets of the capital brought the crisis to the boiling point. Rioters set fire to at least 400 bank branches around town and destroyed numerous government buildings, movie theatres, liquor stores, restaurants, businesses, and other real or imagined symbols of Pahlavi affluence. The security forces ostensibly were absent from the streets, thus allowing the protesters to inflict maximum damage. Whether this was a preconceived SAVAK operation, as was alleged then, or the work of Islamic radicals with a record of incendiary sabotage, remained a matter of speculation. What was clear was that the riots succeeded in bringing the shaky government of Sharif Emami to its knees. The next day, on November 6, 1978, accepting the premier's resignation, the Shah in desperation appointed a military government headed by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Ghulam Reza Azhari, 1912-2001, a mild-mannered general and a devout practicing Muslim with little political or strategic acumen. It was as if the Shah decided on Azhari in a delusional haze atypical of his controlling habits. The military government was appointed with a naive hope of peacefully ending the strikes and bringing the economy back to normal. Azhari took office, understandably, with a degree of reservation as how to govern an almost ungovernable nation. The proactive wing of the Carter administration, headed by Brzezinski, backed Ardeshir Zahedi, a close confidant of the Shah and Iran's ambassador to the United States, were convinced that only a firm military stance could end the revolution and rescue the regime. What ominously seemed a reenactment of the 1953 coup, however, proved to be, citing Marx's famous saying, a second-time farce. Facing millions in the streets, Azhari was not in the mood to stand for such a spectacle. Sensing the gravity of the situation, and under enormous psychological pressure, even the Shah didn't have faith in the success of a military government. His ambivalence doubtlessly trickled down through the upper echelons of the military command. Troubled by the rapid course of events, the murky prospects of his dynasty, and the conflicting messages from Washington, the Shah was unwilling to allow a draconian measure that might result in another bloodbath like Jalet Square. To his credit, bewildered and demoralized though he was, he recognized that by sheer force he no longer could quell a popular revolt led by a determined and charismatic leader and backed by millions in the streets. Prior to Azhari's appointment, the Shah had offered the premiership to Ali Amini, who, emerging from the political wilderness after nearly two decades, wisely turned it down, primarily because of the Shah's refusal to relinquish control of the military. This was one prerogative that he had jealously guarded all of his career, and was not willing, even at the perilous moment of a revolution in making, to relinquish to someone he could barely trust. He also declined Amini's other condition that he leave the country with the prospect of abdicating in favour of his son. Such parallels with Mossadegh's demands in 1953 were too obvious for the Shah to comply with. He evidently still contemplated some future means of restoring his power. The army, it soon became apparent, lacked experience in civil affairs as much as it lacked the resolve to face a restive public. For all the years since 1953, the Shah, and before him his father, assiduously had kept the army officers firmly under their thumbs. Both father and son demanded from all military personnel, and senior officers in particular, nothing short of blind obedience to the person of the monarch in exchange for material privileges and their generous purchases of military hardware. He had engendered in their ranks a sense of order and discipline and a pride in the uniform. Even hardline generals like Ovaisi, who from the beginning of the unrest had called for a systematic crackdown, were quickly forced to retire without much remonstrance from them or their cohorts in uniform. In addition to a culture of blind dependency, the Shah had used as his effective weapon petty rivalries among senior officers and held them at the mercy of his whims and wishes. In doing so, he had deprived the army of a spirit of institutional self-reliance and independent identity. One other systemic factor, barring the officers from acting like a military junta, was a justifiable fear of disloyalty from within their own lower ranks. When it came to enforcing law and order in the streets, the top heavy officer corps relied essentially on unskilled conscripts in their 2-year military service. The soldiers were often villagers and urban immigrants who, though sufficiently indoctrinated in the barracks, were unprepared to face an angry crowd. Even less so were they willing to shoot at men and women essentially like themselves, who were protesting under the banner of Islam and the country. Already by October 1978, warning signs of troop absenteeism and defection were rife. By the end of the year, these were aggravated further into disobedience. On December 14, 1978, in the Lavizan barracks north of Tehran, where the regiments of the Imperial Guard were stationed, a serious case of mutiny unfolded, whereby soldiers shot and killed some 12 of their commanding officers, presumably in retaliation for their anti-revolutionary sentiments. The Air Force cadets, known as Home Afars, the ground support for the Iranian Air Force, were among the first to break ranks and openly support the revolution. They initially were vocal in demanding higher wages and better terms of employment, but soon, on February 8, 1979, they spearheaded mass defection within the Air Force personnel. On the eve of the revolution's success, the Home Afars took to the streets of the capital and fought on the side of the revolutionaries, not entirely unlike the Kronstadt sailors during the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution.